Hello, this is Heidi McAlpine from Well Matters Podcast, Worldly Empowerment, Living and Learning. And I also have with me Josh Folk and Christine Koppel-Gray, the other creators of the podcast. And this podcast aims to connect health and wellness professionals as well as connecting communities on a national and international level. And today we have with us Patricia Preeson, who is a professor at Columbia University. She is a psychoanalyst and occupational therapist. She has won numerous awards, one of them being for her emerging and innovative practice, as well as serving her community. So we hope that you enjoy this podcast, and we're looking forward to hearing from you and other podcasts. Good afternoon. This is Heidi McAlpine from Well Matters, our podcast for NYSOTA and the OT profession in general. And we have here with us Josh Folk and Christine Koppel-Gray. And we're here to interview Pat Preeson and better understand the OT's role in mental health and what she has done in so many different ways for the opioid crisis and addiction, and we want to thank her for that. So welcome, Pat, and Professor.
Thank you, Heidi. Thank you, Jess and Christina, for helping me make this happen. It's quite an honor and a pleasure.
And it's our honor and pleasure for you to take this time out from your schedule. There is so much that you have done. You're not only an occupational therapist, but you have been in the mental health field for 27 years. You have your own practice in the city, and I'm not sure, what is the name of your practice?
I'm a psychoanalyst also, okay. A licensed psychoanalyst, so my practice is in psychoanalysis.
Okay. So what got you interested in that?
Well, as an occupational therapist, I realized as I was working with patients that certain clients, especially in mental health, because I've been in that field my whole entire career, a lot of people seem like they could be capable of following through with functional activities, such as making a budget, but for other reasons, they weren't following their budget. And I thought that they really could. So I felt like I wanted to delve deeper into their psyche and try to understand what was causing them problems and barriers to performing occupations that they said they wanted to do but were finding it difficult to do. So I'm very dedicated to learning more about the human mind on a psychoanalytic level, a neurological level, and trying to bridge all of those with the work that occupational therapists often do in mental health, which is working more with the ego and ego functions.
Okay, right. So where did you find that the barrier was with people who are trying to get past that hump and become more functional within society?
Well, with a particular client that I was thinking about with her budget, she was very capable of making the budget, and it turned out that when I asked her more about what money meant to her, one of her parents had passed away, and that parent had always provided money for her in the form of an allowance. And now that she no longer had that parent, the other parent no longer provided her any money, and she was having feelings about that. So she was actually unconsciously unable to budget for herself because she had a lot of unresolved feelings about the death of her parent and how the other parent was relating to her. So once we got that out in the open and talked a little bit about it, it got rid of the block, and she was conscious about it, that unconscious process, and she was able to follow her budget the way she wanted to. So it's just one example of how people get blocked in various ways from doing what they want to do.
Right. Okay, so you helped find meaning and purpose behind money, and money was just one example that you had mentioned. And that's occupational therapy's role, is helping to find the meaning and purpose behind an activity in order to carry that out.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, you know, we have also worked in mental health, and we find that there are a lot of different barriers. One, subconsciously, and two, stress. How to deal with stress, how to cope. A lot, and it's not just with addiction or with it's in general, mental health in general, it's their ability to be able to function due to the way that they've learned
Yes.
How to deal and cope with stressors, and life has stressors. So can you give an example of how, as an occupational therapist, you were able to help them get past those? And I think I want to mention your book a little bit. You had written a book about living skills recovery, and have heard great things about it. Was able to scan it myself and look through it, and it's there's a lot of those activities that the students were able to use within their fieldwork experience. So I would like you to elaborate that on a little bit more to help us understand it.
Sure, that's great. I would be happy to. I started to write the book in 1999, I think, when it was first published, and it's been recently republished by another distributor a few years ago. So I'm happy that it's still in the mix and people are still using it. That said, I was working at the time in 1999 in a hospital on an outpatient dual diagnosis unit. And by dual diagnosis, I mean people that had mental illness diagnoses and co-occurring substance abuse. And while I was working there, I realized that even though we were treating that population, we were treating them separately. So there was a group called Double Trouble Group that followed the 12-step model and helped them with those issues. Then there were living skills groups that were helping them with the usual occupational therapy-related activities. But there wasn't anything that bridged them together. So this book was an attempt to really bridge those two treatments together so that and any kind of skill acquisition that an occupational therapist would do, it also incorporated the 12-step model. Okay. For instance, if a person wanted to add something into their schedule because they had a lot of time on their hands and they needed to have something else, we would not just ask them to do a regular activity analysis and see what they would like to do and help them incorporate it into their schedule. But in addition, we would ask questions about the pattern of their abuse of their substance. For instance, if the person had gotten triggered to use substances late at night because they were about to go to sleep and they got lonely and they couldn't deal with their loneliness, and so they got up, got dressed, and went to the liquor store. We would help that person find an activity that they could do that was social to prevent the loneliness, that they could do during the night at the last minute notice, maybe something online. And that would be an activity that was added to their schedule, but also address the pattern of addiction so that it would really help them move forward in both areas. Because if you treat individually, it's very difficult to make progress in both areas. Usually make progress in one area and then the other area takes over.
I have to say, as a student, both in your substance abuse class and then in community mental health fieldwork, this Living Skills workbook was definitely probably my absolute favorite textbook, just because it was so easy to relate to real life. And then in the clinic, it was so easy to take the activities in there and just tweak them to make them fit the certain clients that we had and their specific situations. And then in the classroom, it was so easy to bridge the gap between what we were learning and what would actually be happening in the real world when we got there. So thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome, and that's perfect, because that's exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to help the clients on my unit, and I wasn't thinking of making a book, so I'm going to go through this a little bit so people can get my process, understand the process. The first thing was to help the clients. And then I thought, I'm having students, because I'm supervising students on the unit, let's help the students. Let's get the students involved in teaching the living skills to the clients. So I needed group leader plans. And after a while, I had so many of them, I thought, let's make a book out of it and help other people do it. So the book was really secondly involved in helping students make a transition from the classroom to practice. And also to help other practitioners that are working with people, either in mental health or substance abuse or both, use it functionally in the clinics. So thank you. I'm glad it worked.
It definitely did.
So I think that that's great that it's what OT is all about, is keeping it client-centered. How do we keep it client-centered? And you've done a great job with making it relatable. How do you make it relatable, and how do you help students understand who maybe are not familiar with addiction, 12-step programs, how to connect that material that makes it relatable to them, and then they gain that rapport with that sense of understanding.
Well, yes, that is also what I was aiming for, so thank goodness. It's a skeleton. The Living Skills Recovery Workbook is a skeleton for clients to put their lives into. So it's a structure, but it's so specific to the client that it does allow for that connection with the occupational therapist. And it's a non-threatening way to get at some very difficult material for them to get at, both for the OT and for the client.
Right. Exactly. And I think that we could all use stress management because the world has become so busy, and especially being on Long Island in New York City, there's a lot of external distractions. So I think,
yes,
you know, stress management is really important, especially in mental health, not only for our clients, but for ourselves. And it's through our own personal experiences that we're able to share those tools. And then your book is a, like you said, a skeleton. It's an outline of different ways to be able to help our clients to gain that sense, to get past those barriers.
The other, I want to mention one more thing about the book, is
sure,
that it includes an outcomes measure of the effectiveness of the Living Skills.
What outcomes measures are you using?
I looked at several different types. One of the things I looked at was attendance.
Okay.
And another one was, did the clients meet the objectives of each day, each session? So there are four different topics. There are about 15 different sessions in each topic. Each topic has a list of objections for the patient to meet. And so it makes it very easy for the person leading the group each day to just record how many objectives did each person meet. And then you can get a percentage over time when the whole series is finished, or each topic is finished.
Okay, I wasn't sure. Go ahead.
That's a measure of how much material the person was able to learn during the session. Then there are before and after quizzes for each of the topic areas. And if you do a pre and a post test to measure the difference between the groups compared to control groups, you can get an idea of if there were significant differences due to your particular treatment, if most of the other variables in the program are controlled. So that is a long-term measure of how much material was learned, stored, and recalled after 4 months, because the treatment was usually 4 months.
Right. Okay.
And then we looked at staff observations, because they were blind to the study and we wanted to see if they noticed any difference in the client's time management or their stress levels or their activities of daily living, et cetera, and their social skills. So we asked staff to fill out a survey, and then we asked the clients, you know, did you make changes in your life? Did you learn new material? And a series of questions that we got data from. So those were the basic outcomes, and then there were substance abuse outcomes. We looked at the number of relapses, the length of relapse, and the number of clean days to try to incorporate and encapsulate everybody's pattern of addiction. And then we looked at, you know, what was the effectiveness of the treatment in those four topic areas on those variables. And I found very good results. It was very effective on almost all of the areas. But we also looked at goal attainment, which was a measure of could they generalize the material to the outside in their lives.
Okay. Do you use the GAS as a goal attainment, or is it your own, or is it up to the evaluator to do that?
I just counted the number of goals that were set and the percentage met, and how many goals they actually met in each topic area that they set out to meet.
Okay. I think that's great that you connected all of that, because as an occupational therapist, you know that we are evidence-based. So I think that that's great that you give them all of that within that book. And if they want to order that, if anyone is interested working in mental health or in other settings and they want to utilize this, how can they receive that book? How can they purchase that?
It's available on Echo Point Press. So I think it's like $24.99.
Okay.
They can get it there.
Okay. All right, great. Well, we just wanted to make sure that they understood that, because I think that it is a great book. The students have loved it, so that speaks volumes in itself. For somebody to not understand a topic and then utilize something and really enjoy it and say that that is one of their top books, it speaks volumes for you as well.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
So, you know, we spoke a lot about what OT is, how we're working with mental health, how you've created that opportunity. So I just want to ask you a question in regards to the Vision 2025 and AOTA's 2018 annual conference, where we're trying to create our professional future. And as professionals, we are at our own crossroads, and we're prepared to develop infrastructure that will support us throughout 10, 25 years and into the next centennial. I won't be around, but we hope that, you know, the students that we have impressed upon and given them tools and skills that carries on through our profession to only strengthen it. And I know that the profession through Vision 2025 is maximizing health and well-being and the quality of life for all populations, and working with community-based programs to help carry out skills outside of different settings. You know, and to help work with participation so that they can participate in everyday living. So how are you, as an agent of change, creating that for yourself and within your professional setting?
Well, I have some very exciting things going on. Right now, I'm a professor full-time at Columbia University in their OT department. And I'm working with Sharon Gutman on a very interesting project that deals with lucid dreaming. I don't know if people are familiar with lucid dreaming, but what a lucid dream is a dream that someone has where they become aware that they're dreaming within the dream. And everybody has this capability. Some people have them naturally. Other people have never experienced a lucid dream. But there's a lot of literature right now that's coming out on lucid dreaming, and it's showing that if you can become aware in your dream that you're dreaming, you can control the dream. So you're bringing in areas of your brain from the frontal cortex that deals with executive functioning. You're bringing in memory. You're bringing in various areas that are actually being shown to be lit up on functional fMRIs when people are involved in a lucid dream. And that means that the person has the experience that they're manipulating the dream any way they want to. And it's really wonderful because there is no time, there's no space limitation, there's no movement limitation. So you can imagine, if you've ever had one, it's very exciting. I've had them. I've flown.
Yes.
Have you had them?
Yes, I have. I've done a lot of things in my dreams, and I analyze everyone's dreams, and I think they're tired of me analyzing them because I just feel they do speak a lot, because you're in a relaxed state of mind, right? Uh-huh. You're in that deep sleep, and things are happening, and you are an observer. You're on the outside looking in.
Uh-huh.
So that's why
you can do more than observe. You can be in it. You can tell. You can direct the dream.
Yes.
You can say, I want to fly. I want to move my legs. And you could be paralyzed. And you can still make yourself move without being an observer. You can, like if you're being chased by an animal or something, it's very scary. You know, most of our dreams are like that, or nightmares, and we run away in the dream and wake up in a sweat. But if you could become lucid in that moment, you could turn around and ask the scary monster, who are you and what do you represent? And the dream character will tell you, and it won't be a monster, it'll be something different. So you can learn all kinds of things about yourself. Research has shown that it's stronger than mental imagery. So if you're working with patients who cannot move part of their bodies, and in the dream you have them incubate a lucid dream so that they can heal their bodies, they can start to move their bodies in different ways, their brain lights up almost as if they're doing it. So it's very good practice for people that have limitations in the physical world to be able to go into the safe dream space and solve problems, make goals, create goals, figure out things, and actually heal their bodies. So again, this is not something that's mystical, or, you know, it may have been, but people have been doing this for years, for hundreds and thousands of years. And recently we've hundreds of years ago, we've learned how not to do it. We've forgotten how to do it, and we never knew we could do it. And now there's a resurgence of people being able to do it, and they're making huge changes in their lives of all kinds of magnitude. So I want to use it with patients. I want to measure it with our clients. I want to try to develop ways to teach them to be able to do it, and then see if we can help them and guide them with the lucid dreaming in order to make the changes in their lives that they would like.
I think that's fascinating. I would love to just continue to stay connected and to understand the progress that you're having with this. I'd love to, you know, just stay in touch and understand it. Now, you're going to be using this with your clients or your patients. Correct.
I'm going to start with students first. We're going to do a pilot study.
Okay.
And we want to see if we can work out some of the kinks of, you know, first of all, can they learn it? Because, you know, people can learn it, but it's a matter of how are they learning it, what's most effective, and what time is the shortest amount of time period where people can actually learn to do it, so that then I'm developing ways to manage stress and use that in the lucid dream to decrease the stress level of the students. Later, we hopefully would like to use it with patient populations, such as people who are addicted to substances or opioids, because as we know, you know, they need a lot of stress management, pain management, and all kinds of occupational therapy interventions to help them engage in occupation again.
Right, that would actually, have you heard anything about the funding through HEAL, H-E-A-L?
No, I haven't. But I know that there's a lot of new funding coming up because of the new act that's just been passed in October this year, last year.
Right. Well, the National Institute of Health had started this in April of 2018, and HEAL is called Helping to End Addiction Long Term.
Mm-hmm.
And they are creating they want to find opportunities for this funding to work with this.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be something that would actually help fund once you start that.
Thank you. That sounds great.
Yeah, no, that's great. No, I think I like the direction that you're going with stress management, because we need different ideas. We need more ideas to help put the client in the front seat, to feel in control of their choices that are proactive.
Yes, exactly.
So now, will you have your students journaling after their dreams to understand the flow and to be consistent with what's happening?
Yes, because one of the techniques to increase lucid dreaming or to start lucid dreaming is dream recall. So the more people write down their dreams, the better their dream recall, and the more likely they will be to have a lucid dream.
Okay. All right. Well, that's interesting. I'm really
fascinating.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I love about our profession is it can go in so many different directions based on the client's needs.
Yes. I do too.
I think and being able to connect and collaborate with other professionals is a key to that, because I think so many other professionals need to know what's out there and what we have to offer within the community and within different populations. So I would love to just keep on doing this to make that happen.
Yes.
And to create more opportunities for funding and to continue to work with research and work with the National Institute of Health and all the different agencies and organizations that are looking for solutions to these problems.
Absolutely, because you know, in dealing with lucid dreaming, you know, I'm all about finding stakeholders that are from the bottom up or from the top down or in the middle. I don't think it matters. It's where you're at and who you know and how you're going to approach it. But given that, you know, working with dreaming, there are many hospitals such as Columbia University that have dream labs and sleep labs, and they have the equipment. So we have also a lot of neurological doctors who specialize in sleep. So already you're talking about an interdisciplinary possibility. And I really firmly believe in taking function and behavior and looking at what happens with occupational therapy treatment, you know, to the brain. Like, how are you changing structures in the brain? Are you changing pathways? Are you changing synapses? That's going to be shown soon. And we can only do that by working with these other professionals. And they need us and we need them. And I think it's a very nice combination. And I think no matter what kind of clinical work you're doing, or no matter what kind of research you're doing or academic position that you have, if you look around at what's needed, I think you can always use that basic equation of where is the gap, what problems are there, what's needed, how can I implement treatment or something better, and how do I measure that, and how do I collaborate with other people in seeing the bigger picture and what's happening. And then advocating for, if you're successful, what you find.
I agree, and then sharing that research on different sites.
Yes.
So, no, I am total agreement with you, and I love the direction that you're going with your profession, and the interprofessional collaboration is key in order to get that research out there and to provide more support and education and treatment to the community and different settings.
Yes, and that's especially necessary given the opioid crisis that we have right now.
Yes.
Yeah.
As a student, one of the, and continuing currently, one of the first things that really caught me about occupational therapy was just the depth and profundity of the concept of an occupation and everything that entails, and especially how it relates to the idea of meaning, which I think really does lend itself to a psychodynamic frame of reference and using that as a model. But as a student, as we learn about the different frames of references and different models, the psychodynamic frame of reference has a sense of being difficult to access and difficult to learn about. So I'm curious if a student or a new grad or even a current practitioner was interested in learning a little bit more about that way of approaching occupational therapy specifically. Would you have any advice where they could learn a little bit more information or how they might be able to start incorporating that into their practice?
Sure. I've actually written several textbook chapters on the integration of mental health in the physical disabilities realm. Because I think that anybody with a disability, whether it's from birth or an onset, is going to have some kind of psychological issue associated with it, because it's a change, it's an adaptation, etc. So there are several chapters that are out there. There are mentors that are listed, I think, on AOTA and the NYSOTA websites, especially AOTA in the special interest sections that you could probably go to and see if there are mentors that you know, could mentor you or supervise people that are interested in learning more about it. There are other publications that I think are helpful, or to shadow or moonlight an occupational therapist. I know it's hard to volunteer, especially after you just finished all of your schooling and you had to volunteer before you went to school. But there's nothing wrong with, you know, getting a job that's going to, you know, help you live in the world. And also, moonlighting is a volunteer, either with people that are working in those areas, or, you know, if you're interested in research, people that are doing research, or advocating for level twos to include research and not just a practice area.
I actually really like that idea of including research in a level two, because I feel like, as much as I enjoy the curriculum the way it is now, it is very much segregated between research and clinical practice, where I kind of like the idea of bringing them both together, because in the real world, that's how it works. They're both very interrelated.
Yes. Yes, good.
So, Pat, what would be your suggestion, since funding is an issue with occupational therapists in mental health settings? What would be your solution to helping to promote and advocate for OT's role in mental health, especially community mental health facilities?
Well, you know what? Two things. One, you've already mentioned our best practices, and AOTA, AJET has put out many call for papers in areas that need more best practices, mental health and substance abuse being one of them. So I think the more people that are working in the field, the more they publish what they're doing and show effectiveness of these studies, the more we can advocate for funding and to get our foot in the door at different agencies. That said, I think all the kinds of jobs that I have gotten in the community, I don't think any of them advertised for an occupational therapist. In fact, most of them didn't even know what occupational therapy was in mental health. I just applied for the jobs. And some were executive directors, some were managing directors, you know, others were directors. So in taking those jobs, I just had to convince the interviewer what an occupational therapist could add to the administration of a homeless organization or a welfare-to-work organization, which I worked in. And it was so easy for me to do that because OT, not even at the time, but now OT looks at the community or the agency or the population as a client. So I just told them that I would come in as a director and I would analyze the program. I would write a list of strengths and weaknesses, and then I would help talk to people and see what their goals were in the agency, what worked, what didn't work, and then come up with solutions, just like a treatment plan, and then implement that plan for the agency. So in those situations, I became a leader and I introduced occupational therapy to the agency, hired OTs, had OT students, and developed it in places where it didn't exist before. So it just depends on your personality and how you can start it. You know, I started from just the bottom up using what I knew could work. And I'm a firm believer in just going to agencies that already exist, learning more about them from websites, and then, you know, doing your own like little needs assessment before you even meet them, and then go and talk to a director, go and talk to somebody that doesn't have an OT over there, and just say how, gee, OT could be helpful here, let's talk. I developed a SPOTS model, which is sustainable population-based occupational therapy sites. That's what it stands for, SPOTS. And it helps students at a level 2 fieldwork develop their own fieldwork sites with the help of a professor and the fieldwork coordinator. And in doing so, they bring OT to places that don't have OT. And then they set up sustainable sites that other occupational therapists can come to for level 1 and hopefully level 2. So I think by learning just to go and advocate at different levels, whatever level you're comfortable at, it could be at a new site, it could be one person that you're working with, it could be doctors or PTs or friends that you're in school with that you make connections with, and trying to see what you can do as an OT on a higher level in a particular field or agency or emerging area of mental health. I find that the community is very open to OTs and mental health. They usually welcome people with open arms, even if they don't know what it is, because it's so applicable to most nonprofit organizations that are helping people in the community.
Well, Pat, I am aligned right with you on that. As a field work supervisor, I'm really trying to advocate for OT and their role within mental health and helping them understand, just through having students there, what we're capable of and what we have to offer. So I'm right there with you. And now I can understand why you're considered a fellow of AOTA. You've done so much just listening and learning and understanding. I appreciate your time. Is there any last thing that you'd like to do within the last couple of minutes or say for this podcast to help the profession better understand your direction and what you have to offer?
Well, I would like to say that as far as the opioid crisis goes, there are two very important conferences. One is the ATOD conference. It stands for the American Association of the Treatment of Opioid Dependence. They have an annual conference. This year, it's in October, starting the 19th in Orlando, Florida. It's all about that particular treatment and working together. In fact, its title is out of the shadows, managing the opioid epidemic through continuation of care. And we're part of the continuation of care as OTs. So to go there to advocate, to see what other people are doing, will help you and train you as a student or as a new professional, and what you can do and how you can work together with people that are tackling that problem head on. There's also another one called the Harm Reduction International Annual Conference, and it's usually held in a different country every year. The United States is not so good in advocating for harm reduction because a lot of people don't believe in it, but a lot of countries are very well advanced in harm reduction, and personally, I believe in it. I don't think everybody can just quit cold turkey and, you know, never use again. So it's really something that helps the entire community, because you're helping people use in a way that's less harmful to themselves and the community. And I think that's an important direction to consider also for us as OTs.
No, I definitely think that's important, and it helps us to get more involved and to, again, collaborate with other professionals.
Yes.
So I think that's great that you brought that up, and that's definitely something I'm going to look into a little bit more. And I'm trying to advocate health and wellness and well-being through being a yoga therapist and
Wonderful.
Working with mindfulness, certified in that. So I like to bring that into mental health. But this is that other component, too, that helps bring it all together and look at the whole person emotionally, physically, and spiritually.
Wonderful. Well, I hope you're putting out publications and that you can show effectiveness of it, because I think it is so effective. And then that's how we can convince people above that are passing laws and making funding decisions. The more we can, you know, show that we're doing good work, that we're doing.
Right. Well, I guess that means that I'm going to have to publish something, because you've pushed me in that direction, and I'm going to guide myself. And if it's in one of my dreams, I'm going to make it happen and put
awesome.
It out there.
Awesome.
Well, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for all that you've done for the profession and for all that you had to offer us today.
Well, thank you, Heidi and Josh and Christine, for what you've done.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to meeting you sometime in the future.
Yes, me too.
And great. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you. Bye.
Take care.
Well, that was a fascinating interview, and I would like to thank Dr. Preason for her time. One of my biggest takeaways, and which I found very exciting in Dr. Preason's work, was the psychodynamic component inherent in examining the relationship between meaning and doing. As I noted in the interview, I am fascinated by the idea of trying to understand the deeper connections between meaning, volition, and motivation, and I think that Dr. Preason's work is a great example of pushing the boundaries to incorporate a psychodynamic analysis in a way that connects it to occupational performance. It makes me wonder about the benefits of delving further into the relationship between symbol, the unconscious, and real occupational performance. I wonder if it's a method that could reveal occupational barriers that exist at a deeper level in the clients that we work with. Just some more food for thought. Thank you once again for taking the time to listen and think. Please feel free to reach out if you have anything that you would like to share or discuss in the near future on Well Matters. Until next time, take care.